You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.
It's South African musical aristocracy on The Dan Nichols Show this week, as well as a slightly starstruck host, because this is a man who I first encountered by listening on repeat to his music when I was growing up. This doesn't mean that he's enormously old. It just means that I loved the music he was playing as he found his feet. And by God, did he find his feet. He is Emmy nominated. He's won more SAMAs than he can fit into his rather large garage. And he's now looking back very excitedly on one of the great jazz festivals of the world. James Stewart, welcome.
What an introduction, Dan. Thank you so much.
Well, you did write it out for me, so I hope I got it all done. I still remember it would have been my university days at UCT, when in theory I was doing an honours degree in English, and really I was going wine tasting and getting to the beach and other things that BA students do before they become waiters or teachers, which is basically the two end results.
A well-trodden path indeed, yeah.
And I remember the usual coming out with Shape That I'm In, and there was a bit of an argument one evening with a group, because the majority of people were fairly adamant that this was an international band because it was far too good to be a local song, because that was, I think, at the time where we maybe didn't believe quite as much in South African music as I'd like to think we do now. But it just dominated the airways, and that was in a very bromance kind of way when I fell in love with James Stewart and that incredible voice. And it's not a song that I or anybody else would have heard if life had happened a little differently, because at one point, and this seems to happen so often when I have these conversations, there was a very good chance of James Stewart the lawyer.
Well, while we're both studying our BA and parts of LLB and doing what we could to, I guess, stay out of the army. I think it was always going to happen. The music was always there. Certain things aligned. I was doing my articles, and you know, as you do as a new clerk, you tend to get the jobs that the older guys don't want. So I was doing plenty of divorces and liquidations and sequestrations and car accidents and all the fun stuff, and learned a tremendous amount. It's informed an enormous amount going forward, specifically in the music industry, which, as you know, is full of ways to mess up. So the law side of things has been very, very useful, but halfway or three quarters of the way through articles, opportunities arose that I just couldn't say no to. So I put them down briefly and never quite picked them up until recently, when I've been deep in artist contracts and all sorts of other agreements. So it's been useful. And yeah, the band sort of just started as a sort of a long tail, and then suddenly, you know, hockey sticked. Primarily when Tom came down from Johannesburg, he was the singer and guitar player in Bright Blue, and you know, the famous Weeping song that was written by Dan Heyman, and an opportunity to play with a guy like that. So when he was absorbed into the band, and things really just kicked off at that point, and it all had seemed to happen very suddenly, and it was a beautiful, beautiful time.
You came together as some very clear musical talents. When did that first emerge? Were you the three-year-old prodigy dazzling the family over Christmas around the piano? Did it happen a little later than that?
No, but there was always a sense that this was something that was mine. You know, that I wouldn't call myself a loner or sort of an introvert or whatnot, because I'm kind of okay in the world, and but sitting at the piano and noodling around and finding things and sort of, you know, discovering, you know, like they're mine, it became personal quite quickly. So there was brass bands and there were choirs and there was the piano, and then there was just the pressure of measuring up to the guys in the room, you know, playing with such extraordinary musicians and needing to stretch and needing to ensure that we had, you know, great lyrics and good songs. And, you know, we had limited production, so our production philosophy was actually quite simple. We just got to play it as well as we can. We had 8-track tape machines, not sort of fancy computers. And it was just about getting it right and making sure that we could deliver on melody and lyrics. And that was the idea. And we just seemed to have that right song at the right time, just as South Africa was programming for South African music. And there was also, you know, a sense, and I think possibly, you know, where we dominate and or not dominate, where we compete and do so well in the world in so many respects as South Africans, but particularly in sport, is, you know, we've got to do things our way. And there's every bit of wisdom involved in copying the things that work and absorbing them into our own DNA. But we agreed quite early on that if we're going to absorb influences, that they'd be from nearby, you know, vocal styles, guitar styles, without trying to be specifically an African band. We just felt that we need something in our DNA that sort of separated us out from everything else that was on radio at the moment. And and that sound was just special. So yeah, it was when thinking back on it, you know, just great, beautiful days.
I'm one of many, many kids who had piano lessons forced upon them as a rite of passage. And although I think most of those piano teachers have since passed on because they were in their late 90s anyway when they were attempting to teach me, I do send a retrospective apology because all I wanted to do was be outside playing cricket and football and tennis and rugby and not sitting in front of a very old, slightly out of tune piano in a dusty room trying to learn my keys and my sharps and my flats. And I look at my two children now. My son is an entry-level Lisa Simpson attempting to work his way around a saxophone. The enthusiasm needs some work. But my daughter will go and sit for hours in front of the piano. And she plays, I think, beautifully. And of course, I'm a very unbiased father. But far more important than how well she does or doesn't play is I can see she's genuinely passionate about it. What was that element for you, that falling in love with music and realizing it was more than just something to do?
Well, I sort of went through the same obligatory music lessons, and I wasn't particularly diligent. There were things that I kind of wanted to own and know, but they were just sort of a little bit ahead of my technical station. So my left hand was weak, and I was told it was weak, and I was excused from the end of term concert at school, which was both a huge relief and also a kind of an incredible kind of insult at the same time, which is so weird. But and those sort of moments informed a desire to almost show myself. I always wanted to sort of strike out on my own and find something that worked for me. And I found that I could do that in music because I think nobody else was involved. I could decide what this is. So the piano lessons, they can be, I guess it's like fitness for sport. It's probably you just got to get it done because the purpose and the importance of it is obvious, but it's just not fun, and nobody likes doing scales. But again, to reemphasize that idea, and I so get it with your daughter. It's the idea of something that is entirely yours, and if the rest of the family goes out for a meal without you or whatnot, you can sit at the piano, pick up your guitar, pick up your saxophone, and just disappear for a while. And anything that goes just needs to be rubber stamped by you, and that's what it is. It gets a bit more complicated when people have to make decisions about what they think is nice and whether you get, you know, the record deal and the record company, other people coming into that private space, and that's often where some issues can occur. But essentially, that sort of seed of creativity is, this is mine. It's a personal relationship with something absolutely possibly beautiful. Yeah.
It's also something that can germinate into an incredible cool factor, especially when you're late teens, early 20s. The person who can play music is very much looked up to in the social circle. The closest I ever came to that was being a very bad DJ at university. I still remember 7,000 people at the UCT O Week partying away as I played other people's music. It was short-lived, but it was great fun being on that stage and getting that sense of seeing other people enjoy music. When did that first come onto your horizon that you could do something that wasn't just giving yourself so much joy?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, it just seems everybody loves music, and to be around that, there's all sorts of conversations of all kinds that spring from that, from a business, creative, all sorts of conversations, which has been terribly useful in my latter life. You know, the music guy. People come to you as if you're an expert in some sort, and I suppose there's a sorcery to it, which is kind of quite cool. But yeah, being around that, and also I remember watching, it must have been school holidays in June, July, because I grew up in Hart Bay and the rain was sort of horizontal, sort of hitting the window. Hart Bay was miles away from anything. And the police came on the radio. I didn't know what it was. And I discovered Walking on the Moon for the first time, and I heard the style of music that was all switched around, and there was space emphasis rather than dense production. And I borrowed or stole a VHS of The Police live in Atlanta, and a VHS cassette, which I just watched on repeat for that entire school holiday. And I'd sort of get to the end. It was produced by Godley and Cream, which is just because you can see the credits rolling, and then I would just rewind that tape and go back to the beginning. Good evening, Atlanta. And I just remember sort of that the final chord of So Lonely, the last song, just chiming over and over and over again. And this feeling of, imagine being able to make people feel like I feel now. And that is my sole reason for being involved in music. It's not about celebrity or fame. Money's good. you know, got to have the stuff. But the idea of being able to reach someone, communicate with someone, and make them feel what, you know, that a way that you can only really feel by looking at a beautiful sunset or a fantastic piece of artwork. Something reaches inside you. There's some form of chemistry and association that happens. And being part of that is just an immensely amazing thing.
Most of our audience, much like myself, very young, hip. So I will put a link onto our website, to the Wikipedia page, so people can find out what a VHS is, the videotape. Go and research it. It was quite a fun thing many years ago. That translation from, okay, I've watched the Police do this. I've watched Sting do this. And it's something I'd love to do myself. Do you remember the first time, the first stage you were on where you got that feeling yourself?
Absolutely. You know, school socials, just being excited for 3 weeks before the show. The idea of just connecting with three other guys and, you know, and being absolutely horrible at it, and getting better. I've had moments on stage, on bigger stages and smaller stages, where something just sort of connects and clicks on stage, and you absolutely emphatically know in your own mind that this right now, this is the biggest and most important and fantastic band in the whole world. There's this collective energy that occurs when in ensemble. I kind of lived for that for a bunch of years. You know, it was all I wanted to do. Nothing else was terribly important.
I'm very envious of the end result. I'm not envious of the process, because I know how much work goes into it. And of course, there's a slight talent shortfall as well. But when I see bands on stage and the electricity you can generate, for me, that's just such a magical space to be in. And there is something about a band, often like a sports team, where sometimes it's not always necessarily the best 11 or the best 15. It's how those 11 or 15 come together.
Exactly right.
And make the greatest sum of the parts.
Exactly right. Exactly right. It's in the small percentages. The two words you've used, especially magic. I don't know what this thing is. I certainly know that, you know, by painting or drawing or writing or playing or whatever you do, developing vocabulary and potential words and language that you may use or incorporate at some time is always important. Exposure to, you know, interesting ideas, but how it all comes together, is still a bit of a mystery to me.
Let's go back to fledgling lawyer. And this is of particular interest to me because my wife is a lawyer, which means I win lots of arguments at home, and she's Greek. You're in this space. I think back to recently we had Chef Ton, arguably the biggest celebrity chef in Bangkok with his Michelin star restaurant, talking about his journey where a month into working for a corporate bank, having studied finance, he had to phone his mother and his grandmother and tell him, no, this is just not for me, and I'm throwing in the towel. And this was this really exciting corporate career. It's worked out massively for him, but he did say goodbye to the horror of his family to the world of finance. Yeah. What was the conversation like for you when you had to say to family, to relevant people, you know what? Yes, it looks like I am the next edition of Suits, or at that stage probably would have been LA Law and Corbin Burnson. But instead, no, I'm going off on this musical journey.
I actually didn't expect the conversation to go as well as it did. My parents were incredibly gracious about it. I think they essentially said, you know, you need to be happy in your life. You know, I'm sure they must have been concerned. It's a complete gamble. But I believe they also saw that here was probably the one instance in my life, besides surfing, which I had an absolute total obsession with growing up. It was something that they could see I was willing and able to do what was required, and they saw a consistency perhaps that maybe hadn't been evident until that point. So they kind of, look, giving me their blessing was important, but I was going to do it anyway.
The shift from lawyer, suit, tie to uber cool, postmodern James Dean, musical superstar is different in so many ways. I'd imagine there was an element of relief because you had made that decision and this is who I now know I want to be and believe I can be. What else, though, changed at a fundamental level in James Stewart?
Look, there was a few months prior to making that decision, there was a sort of an unfamiliar sort of feeling in my stomach, and I identified it, and I can remember quite specifically when it was, and the words kind of, oh, I'm unhappy. And, you know, happiness is important. Managing our emotions and our kind of our reality is also important. And what shifted moving from one building in Kiram Street to another one in Loop Street, and you know, on the fifth floor of the Twin L building, and meeting my partner then, Richard Black, who'd offered me a job as a tape op, essentially. He'd been recording us at night at Street Level Studios, which was a sort of an offshoot of the audiovisual company that he worked at. And I went straight into, I remember coming up that, you know, that goods lift and, you know, in jeans and my t-shirt and my tackies and sort of just really, I mean, totally, what was I, 20, 23, you know, feeling absolutely liberated and going in and interestingly sort of starting to write commercials for, I think the first commercial I wrote was for Pick and Pay, and then there was a cider commercial, it was somebody who was trying to make cider cool. And then I got a Bell's music job. So I got straight into creativity of a, or expression of creativity in a sort of a corporate-y kind of commercial world, which I also thoroughly enjoyed, you know, sort of taking somebody's idea of how this thing needs to be, looking at a storyboard and guys rowing across the Berg River Dam and the Fly Fishing Academy with this beautiful Bells piece of music, and then watching that being played by an orchestra being conducted by Mike Campbell. I mean, just incredibly kind of rewarding stuff, and earning less money than I was as an article clerk, because they basically said, if you want to, you know, we can find you a position here, and they found me a position, but they saw something in me as a creative, and probably felt they could ride that, and they certainly did, because I wrote on quite a bit of TV and film and commercial stuff over the years, but at nighttime we were recording bands.
So there's a lot of music out there that people have heard, would immediately recognize, they just don't know that it's you.
Quite possibly. That Bell's commercial thing was amazing. It was a couple of hours work of ideas that were sort of in the back of the mind, written to a sort of a sketchy sort of offline edit. And it lasted for 15 years. Amazing.
The band came together with, I think, the right people at the right time, and it worked out brilliantly. What was the watershed moment, to reference another band, where you felt that, you know what, this is more than just a group of guys together who really enjoy music, that you really did have something special?
Well, I'll reference another piece of technology called a DAT tape. I don't know if you remember those. So we've done VHS.
My parents remember them well.
So this is all pre-digital, you know, recording to a hard drive directly. It was a digital audio tape. And I'd asked Tom Fox, who'd moved down from Johannesburg. Okay. I knew he was in town. So I basically booked him for guitar session work for every single job that I had, regardless of whether I felt he was the right guitar player or not. So I booked him for everything, and eventually asked him whether he would produce two songs for the band, which was actually on ice at that time, because our guitar player had left 18 months to go and fulfill some commercial obligations that he had. And Tom agreed. And the result of that session was The Shape That I'm In, and the B-side of that cassette single called If I Gave You My Heart. And that tape sat next to the monitor speaker in the studio, and I played it to anybody that would come into the studio. And I think and they were all musicians, and they were all getting free studio time. So I thought they were sort of kissing my ass a little bit, saying, "Yeah, no, it's absolutely amazing." But it went off to 5FM, and somehow it just got into the right hands at the right time, and it just took off. So that moment of the right song at the right time, which seems to have proven itself over the years, just led to, you know, better quality of bookings for the bands. It meant we could get a good manager, a good booking agent. Things could be organized. We could focus on doing the things that we're actually good at. And then onto the road, you know, and up and down the garden route and off to Johannesburg and doing all those amazing things that only a 25-year-old or 24-year-old liver can cope with, you know.
It did seem to be a time in South African music where there was self-discovery from amongst the bands themselves, but also from us as a country, where we suddenly realized, you know what, we've got some really good talent. And there was a lot of exciting music at the time. What did it feel like being part of that wave?
Well, the most significant thing for me was an absolute dogged need to not be listened to because we're South African. I needed to be listened to and heard because we're good.
Because you're really good.
That was, so that whole local is lekker situation didn't really work for me. You're either delivering on the goods or you're not. And we really, really, really wanted to write, you know, the best songs possible and play them as well as possible. I mean, speaking of watershed moments and speaking of Bright Blue, there was an end conscription campaign a couple of years before that at the Good Hope Center. I'm talking nothing but white elephants now. They're all they're all over. But we were the usual on a massive bill, including Brenda Fassie, et cetera, like the titans of South African music. So we were on at 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I wanted to see Bright Blue and a whole bunch of the other bands. And I, you know, the crowd, the house lights go down, it goes black, and the crowd goes, you know, that sense of energy happens, and then this blue sweeping light, and there's being da-dum, that bass drum for Weeping, and this moment happens, and I can vividly remember going. I mean, I knew the song. Everyone knew the song. But to see it being played and watch people respond to it, I kind of thought, okay, cool. This is a benchmark for me. If I'm going to write songs, it has to be this good or better. And that's a massive benchmark to set for yourself, because that's a proper song. It's got a deep, profound story. The metaphor is just on point. The South African musicality of it, it's our music. And you can tell because the Groban version and other versions just don't have that South Africanness, you know. Mm-hmm. And those types of seminal moments have informed. And I'm not the most sort of driven, ambitious kind of dude, but sometimes when something happens, it's observed and it's absolutely apparent and absolutely clear. And I've set my sights on stuff like that on a few occasions, and they've directed my journey very strongly since then. So I'm not quite sure if I lost track of your question there, but
no, you summed that up perfectly. I'd also, I love hearing people's own personal highlights, because often when we look from outside, we think, oh, well, when you scored that century or when you won that Golden Globe, that must have been the big one. And often there's a slightly more personal one for somebody. Mm. So if I look at this career, and especially these early stages, what was the highlight for you? Was it a particular concert with 10,000 people screaming? Was it a song that maybe didn't make the same heights but just meant something so much to you? What were one or two of those moments that have a really James Stewart feel?
There have been some incredible sort of rock and roll moments. You know, we've played on small stages, we've played on bigger stages, we've played with some fantastic other bands and musicians. We've recorded internationally but primarily it was about the four of us sort of delivering on what we felt was just something super special, and it took a while for it to get together, but when it did, it was just there without a trace of corniness at all. The most significant moments have always been the connected moments. Remember Roxy's Midnight?
I do indeed.
So we sort of played there quite a few times, sort of on the way up. We played there, and there was a reasonable crowd there. And I remember, well, I'll start at the second time we were there. This couple came bounding up to us after the show, and I'd sort of made the recollection, because this same couple had their tongues down each other's throat for the entire set, and they were sort of just over there, and it was quite a, you know, we're kind of looking, but they got engaged on that night to our song. You know, and then there've been other instances, like Gravity has been the first song at the, you know, when you've realized that your music, the things, these little things that you've put together in your own mind that are so special to you have relevance in other people's lives to the extent that they include them in important moments. You know, is there anything kind of cooler than that?
Well, that is so special, and you will always be their band. And
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like sadly the engagement got called off a month later, but. We should actually track them down, see where they are.
Yeah, I didn't get a name, but yeah, that's just
all right. Well, look, wonderful. If you were listening at the moment, if you got engaged to a usual concert
at Roxy's Rhythm Bar, circa 1998,
do get in touch. The moments that you've had, there are so many, and they have included many other musicians, many other artists. What's been the most starstruck moment, either sharing a stage or just somebody has come up to you weren't expecting and said, gee, I love your music?
I'll tell you what, trumpet player's name, Hugh Masekela, Bra Hugh. He knew our drummer Paul's dad, trombone player or something, at some point. And Paul introduced the rest of us to Hugh Masekela, who said that the band swings.
That's such a cool way of summing it up.
And he was so cool and so gracious and such a giant at the same time and so possessing of gravitas. It was an extraordinary moment. You know, I don't think he really knew how significant that was. It was to us, you know, to be qualified in a way as a South African musician. I am a South African. That's who, in many senses defines my approach. And there's so many, you're South African enough, right, Dan?
Completely. I think that is such a special one. And
you know, and we see it. I mean, the ownership that I've taken, I play a lot with a guy called John Ellis at the moment. He's got a band called Tree 63, fantastic musician.
And the brother of one of the better UCT cricketers played with. Bowled some decent off spin and some lusty middle order batting.
Lusty middle order batting, how beautiful is that? So, I mean, my John Ellis story, my Tree 63 story, and sort of talking about South Africanness was walking out of the street level studios into the foyer, the radio was on, it was 5FM probably, and hearing the song and then hearing it again, and whoever the DJ was didn't back announce it, but I was captivated by the song. There was the sound, and it was the same kind of moment as that walking on the moon story where I needed to know what it was. I actually went to Musica in Cavendish Square. Another white elephant.
To clarify, there used to be once upon a time shops where you would go to physically buy music. Yeah. Half the people listening will have no concept of what this is, but they did used to exist once upon a time.
I mean, I don't know what I was expecting, but this record store attendant, it was probably a Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock, you know, somewhere between Wednesday and Thursday, and needed a snack, a little grumpy or whatnot. But he asked me whether I could sing a few notes of it. I knew that there were lights and stars involved. But eventually I worked out that the song was A Million Lights by Tree 63. And I went out and bought it. On that cover, I realized that it was a South African artist. And that South Africanness, it goes from I love this, it's like I love rugby, and then I love the Springboks. It's like a whole different, you know, level of ownership. And again, I think I've veered off into some strange tangent here, but perhaps you can pull me back.
No, I think it's such a lovely way of remembering things that, yes, the South African context is fantastic, but it's also something that just on its own terms is really, really good. And I think that speaks to some of the awards you've won. I think you actually had to build a second garage to put the other Sambas in. But tell me about an Emmy nomination. Yes, you didn't win it, and that was obviously the fault of the judges, who clearly didn't know what they were talking about. But to be nominated for an Emmy is a slightly different accolade. It puts you in a different space.
Well, that was wonderful. I, through my various phone calls and connections, have developed a wonderful songwriting collaboration, with a guy called Andy Gundull, who's a 14 or 15 time Emmy Award winner. We wrote a couple of songs together. We're still fantastic friends. We talk very often. He's in Connecticut in the States. And I had a song which was sort of inspired sort of by a kind of a chordal progression, which growing up in a church school, it had that kind of thing. And I had a la 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 kind of thing. And it felt hymnal and anthemic. And I sent it off to Andy. And he immediately came back on email saying, this sounds like a Julie Gold song. And Julie Gold is the lady that wrote From a Distance that was sung by Bette Midler that won a Grammy. And very, very quickly, that turned into some lyrics, which are popped onto the piano vocal that I had. And it went from an anthemic chordal thing to la 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 to some words. And that found its way to Joe Arthur, who's an incredibly successful and a loved South African music producer. Mm-hmm. Who produced this thing into a glorious production featuring a choir and Victor Masondo on bass and just fabulous. And it sat there sort of not knowing kind of where its home was. It didn't sort of feel like it belonged on an album. It felt like something kind of special. It felt like a prayer. So we approached the Desmond Tutu HIV Foundation and asked whether we could maybe get the Archbishop Desmond Tutu to speak a voiceover of the lyrics at some point, which he did. Cold, without listening to the music, not in the studio, in his office. He did two takes of it. We pulled it into the studio, dropped it into the mix. I think we tightened up a little section here, and it just fitted perfectly. The consummate pro was just unbelievable. And that song sort of found its way into various fundraising capacities. And also onto a documentary called Voices in Conflict, which was nominated for an Emmy. So it was nominated as part of that soundtrack. A very proud moment, yeah. And as you say, it didn't quite make it, but it's still a beautiful piece of work that's got its own story and a song that was written because it needed writing. And again, sort of just these little pieces of magic connecting and finding your way into, I mean, imagine working with Julie Gold. Wow, you know?
Well, you want to hear her talking about working with James Stewart. It's a big moment.
She has been very kind, actually. She's a lovely lady.
The spill into the international world has now taken a slightly different direction because as we speak, you are preparing for, so by the time everybody's listening to this, it will have already played out with great success, but you've been very, very instrumental in bringing the Montreux Jazz Festival to South Africa. It's the second biggest jazz festival in the world in Montreux in Switzerland. And now, together with all sorts of supporters, people like Ned Bank, you've come into Franschhoek, as we know it as a home of great food. We know it's a home of great wine. There's loads of great history. And now it is going to become one of the jazz capitals of the world.
As you're saying it, I'm just also in amazement of how this whole thing the whole story has evolved and developed. It's been absolutely fantastic. I've been living in Franschhoek with my family for 20 years and developed a reputation as the music guy. And as we're saying, you know, the conversation around music is, you know, do you like this or my son's into this or what do you think of that? And it's led to amazing conversations with incredible people. And Franschhoek is populated by an enormous amount of people with incredible human, you know, capital that are doing amazing things. Some are semi-retired. There's massive fundraising going on. There's all sorts of incredible marketing ideas going on. Our wine farms, our restaurants. It's a vibrant place. So I found my way into a conversation with Mark and Rafaela Goedvolk, who are the founders of Montreux Jazz Festival, Franschhoek, who are Montreux Jazz converts. They go like, you know, they've been every year for the last 10, 11 years. And I'm not quite sure exactly how the conversation with Mathieu Jaton, who's the current CEO that took over from the founder, Claude Nobbs. I'm not exactly sure how the conversation started, but there are additions and there have been additions in Miami, Rio, Tokyo. So the possibility of an African version became apparent. And the similarity, if you like, between Franschhoek and Montreux is kind of palpable. It's both started in lifestyle hospitality. Claude Nobbs was in hospitality that then got into tourism. So it just felt like the idea of Montreux Jazz Festival as a fitting soundtrack, I suppose, to what we offer as a little town that punches above its weight became incredibly exciting, incredibly quickly, and it's been quite an undertaking. But it's been fantastic. So I was asked to sort of apply a musical vantage point, if you like, up front and help assemble some people that could pull this thing together. And we've got an amazing team.
What for you as a musician is the most exciting of seeing so many world-class talents, both established and up-and-coming, making Franschhoek their home for a weekend?
I can see thinking as a musician and, you know, I can't speak for people that have achieved the kind of success that a lot of these artists, you know, have. But I do know that at the heart of it is they do what they do because they do it. And the venues that they play in around the world, I'm sure, are wonderful. And they range from probably quite corporate to fantastic European theaters. But if we can get the weather right, we've got everything else right. And we can create something that will be so spectacularly magical that I believe we may be batting off people to join us next year. The site itself at the monument for the arches for the main stage is just unbelievable. I think you drove past it this morning.
I did indeed.
It's an extraordinary setting surrounded by the mountains. The music will be on Friday and Saturday from about lunchtime till about midnight, and there's going to be all manner of natural wonder surrounding us, beautiful sound system, fantastic artists, very, very well curated by our team. And then, of course, we've got the Jazz Village as well, which we are paying specific and particular respect to jazz, which is Montreux Jazz Festival. It's inspired by jazz, but of course a multi-genre undertaking. So I think that our primary objective is to fuse and bring together everything that is Franschhoek with music to create those sensational moments where I believe, because I see tourists on a perfect summer's evening in March or late, you know, early autumn evening, and they're wandering around after a beautiful glass of wine in a fantastic restaurant somewhere, or they've taken in a wine tram tour, and they are literally, you can see because they're walking in the middle of the road and not paying particular attention to the traffic. They are star-eyed, and I know why. You know, it's so to be able to enchant musicians in the same fashion is the objective, and I believe that's what we're going to do.
It's a benchmark event for South African music, and I think it's going to inspire so much more to come. Where for you does it fit into the general health of South African music at the moment?
The lineup is, and you may have noticed, but we announced our South African and African artists first. It was a strategic decision that we took because this is Montreux meets Africa, not trying to duplicate an international brand specifically in South Africa. We were given license to do this our way. So the significance of a festival of this nature in a town as opposed to a specific site somewhere, you know, a farm out somewhere or a building somewhere where we're actually sort of taking over the town by way of Montreux Mile and encouraging people to sort of enjoy Franschhoek for what it is and ensuring that the artists, I mean, they're traveling fairly far south to be with us, you know, so there's a commitment beyond just wanting to play a show. The proximity of artists to people and the proximity of artists to artists, I think just that language that gets spoken, not just in the masterclasses that we'll be having where there can be touch and feel and questions and those types of things, but just the ability to be able to deliver on this intimate level is what makes artists tick. And I think that develops a currency of its own. And when we cast forward our minds into the next 3 years or 4 years or 5 years, I think it's going to be a significant destination on the South African map. And we're looking forward to developing it for those very reasons.
So a very welcomely upbeat assessment of the broader musical horizon. What of the personal music horizon? There are whispers on subreddit groups regularly about the usual reforming for North American tours and taking Southeast Asia by storm and more likely giving a few of us a burst of nostalgia. What is to come? What are you working on other than a rather large jazz festival? What would you still like to do musically?
Connect. I play with John Ellis relatively frequently. We love the same things and the things that I haven't been exposed to, he's shown me and given me access to. And there's that language that still is spoken between us. Our voices work well together. Our keyboard and guitar playing respectively works well together. We create the sound together. So as far as the usual is concerned, if that was a possibility, I'd do that I'd take that every day. A beautiful, beautiful band with fond memories and lovely songs. But music, look, essentially, if I had to give one word for what I do, I'd probably say creative or musician. It's the thing that I feel I have the most leverage or kind of ownership of in my life. And it's also sort of the maverick of me said, you know, again, it's mine and I can do what I want with it and people can like it or leave it or, you know, and that kind of thing. So it's something that I'll always do. I haven't got any specific plans for world domination, but I do know that I'll be playing and continue to play as long as it feels good.
I think music is one of those things that you never retire from it. You never put it on a shelf. It's always in the DNA. It's always in the blood.
As long as the arthritis stays at bay and, you know.
Final one, because you have a jazz festival to prepare for. When I do come around, because you finally invited me to come around and visit your collection of South African Music Awards, and I've set aside 7 hours to do so.
Sure.
When I stroll into the Stewart Mansion just outside the Franschhoek CBD, what's likely to be playing? What's the soundtrack of the Stewart household?
Well, I've got a son who's a fierce lover of music. Jack is an aspiring DJ, and his playlist is varied and wide, from Fleetwood Mac to DJ Kent to Mapariso to he's been playing The Police. He's just got into Sam Fender and Alicia Keys and Olivia Dean. So that kitchen, it's always louder than it needs to be. But he's got a good ear for it. So I'm looking forward to. I'd just ask Jack to
to curate it.
Yeah, exactly. Good word. Yeah.
You're in a better position than me. We're just coming off a brutal school-run K-pop Demon Hunters soundtrack spell, which almost killed me. But it's one of the things I love doing is on the way to school, we have this balancing act where the kids want to listen to something horrendous that's out on the charts at the moment. In fairness, it's often quite good. But then I'll throw them back to hear some of the music that I grew up with. And I love seeing a current generation discover the music of an older generation.
It's amazing.
And see how timeless so much of that music
is. It's absolutely amazing. And it's just going from strength to strength. It's astonishing to think that some of these songs that my kids are listening to are like 40 years old. Astonishing. And still absolutely relevant and beautiful tunes, properly considered. Very, very exciting. And also the sort of immediacy of music. Spotify. I mean, a long, long time ago, listening to these first guys coming to the studio that were just, you know, from a production perspective, you're saying, well, I want the drums to sound like this and the guitar like this. And I'll say, well, I mean, kind of my first thing was like, how does that work? And the guy's like, well, watch me. And that's the sense that these guys have just got more colors than perhaps we had, because we got into what we got into. Now there's just this huge menu of stuff, and it's just fascinating to see what they do with it.
My children's musical education will continue. They've got another week next week of the usual non-stop to and from school.
Good for you.
They shall be better children for it. And I'm a better person, not just for having been able to listen to so much music, but being able to spend some time with you over the years. And it's always been a great pleasure, and none more so than today. So thank you for sharing the story. Thank you for pulling together the Montreux Jazz Festival. I know you've been very quiet in terms of how much credit you take for it, but I know you've done a huge amount of work to make it happen. And I think in 5-10 years time, as well as looking back at the incredible band and the musical career, we'll be looking back at this as such an important part of your own South African musical legacy.
You make me feel very proud, Dan. You're gracious and kind, and thank you for having me. And it's been a wonderful chat, and I look forward to many more of them.
If you missed it in 2026, buy tickets now, not like next week, but now. Pause this, go and buy them, come and listen to the last few seconds, because the Montreux Jazz Festival in Franschhoek is going to become not just a great South African event, but one of the great musical pilgrimages of the world. And my guest today, James Stewart, not just the man behind The Usual and so much other incredible music over the years, is somebody who has done an incredible amount to give us a South African music event like no other.
You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.